Our next case this morning is number 06-14-14, Diego Gill against James Reed, et al. Mr. Levin.
May it please the Court. In its prior opinion in this case, this Court held that Gill presented sufficient evidence to proceed to trial on his Eighth Amendment and 14th Federal Tort Claims Act claims. None of that evidence has been withdrawn. The material factual disputes this Court found before are still there. There is some additional evidence that entered the record following the remand, but that only creates more factual disputes and makes it more of a need for a jury. What's remarkable is that the appellees appear to agree that there are a lot of material factual disputes regarding what happened and why, but they simply want the Court to disregard Gill's evidence, deeming it non-credible. However, as the Court has stated many times, it's not the role of a court on motions for summary judgment to weigh the evidence and resolve the factual disputes. That's for the jury at trial. So it's true that the record is now larger than it was before. There's the deposition testimony in particular of Dr. Kim, the colorectal specialist who performed the second rectal prolapse surgery, and the expert report and affidavit of Dr. Jeffrey Harms. They both testify to the effect of the various deprivations and deviations in Gill's treatment. But this new evidence doesn't eliminate the other evidence in the record or uncreate the genuine issues material fact that this Court found previously. It only adds to the record, creating more factual dispute for the jury to resolve. So there really isn't any read for this Court to get into what that is. It's already found all the necessary elements of the claim, and it can simply reiterate its prior conclusions.
Now, are you confident that at this point, whatever might be necessary in the way of expert evidence that would support Mr. Gill's claim, if believed, is in this record?
Well, I believe that we would look into additional expert evidence. So far, we didn't get it because of cost. And we believe that there was a sufficient amount because of what was in Dr. Harms and Dr. Kim's testimony, which we actually believe supports our ability to go to trial. But what I can represent to the Court is the expert evidence in the record is the only expert evidence that we have so far.
Well, I mean, I guess I'm just saying there's a threshold to get past summary judgment, and you have to have enough for that. I realize at trial people often go beyond that threshold, but are you confident at this point, given what Dr. Kim has now said, for example, that you still have enough to get over the summary judgment barrier?
Your Honor, this Court already held that it was enough to, and there's nothing new, nothing was taken away. The summary judgment standard isn't any different if someone's going pro se versus represented. For that, I'd refer the Court to the Jones versus Phipps case and the Nolan case in the Eighth Circuit, which holds that the substantive and procedural burdens are the same. So as this Court held before, his angry reaction following the change in prescription, as well as the fact that he rewrote the prescription saying, please obey these orders, that sufficed to create a genuine issue material fact as to Reed. And a jury is completely, even though I recognize Dr. Reed has concluded to the contrary in his deposition, but a jury is free to disregard that. I would point the Court to Chambers versus Ingram and Dodge versus Steen. In Chambers, this Court held the violation of the standard of care is up to the jury. In Dodge versus Steen, it holds that an expert opinion can be disregarded even if it's uncontradicted. So here, if you look at Dr. Kim's testimony, and actually looking at that, what he says is, okay, if someone's going to be given a constipating pain medication, they should be given laxatives to take it up. But here, Dr. Reed canceled all the laxatives. There's also question.
But before you get beyond that, I mean, I think what you're arguing, if I understand you correctly, is that Dr. Kim himself can't erase issues of material fact that his earlier testimony and his earlier actions, actually, his earlier medical notes may have raised simply by saying something else later.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So at most you would have a credibility issue about what Dr. Kim really thinks, since he said A and he said perhaps not A, or he said maybe A, or he said some qualified version of A.
I disagree, Your Honor. The evidence now, it's competing evidence.
Well, that's what I mean. He said, before, the only thing we had in the record was Dr. Kim's instructions as to what medication was supposed to be dispensed for Mr. Gill, Dr. Kim's angry reaction when it didn't happen, his rewriting the prescription, saying words to the effect of, please do it this time, or whatever he said. And I'm understanding you to be arguing he can't erase the effect of all of that evidence simply by now saying in the middle of litigation, oh, well, I think the standard of care was met. Oh,
correct. And we would be able to question him about his affiliation with the hospital in terms of performing surgeries and why he changed his testimony. So we believe what the court found that there was a minimum quantum of evidence to meet the standard before, and all that evidence is still there. And so that's why I'm arguing the court doesn't need to go further than it previously did, because it previously found there was enough. Mm-hmm. So, and in fact, I think you'll find that a lot of the district court's rulings are exactly what this court decided before. It held that Gill didn't suffer injury. This court found that Gill suffered sufficient injury to proceed to trial. This is on the claim against Penaflor. And so there, I don't really think this court needs to really look beyond.
Well, and in fact, some of the things that Harms and Gill said don't mean, or at least might not necessarily mean, what the district court thought they meant. They said things like you don't give antibiotics for pain, which of course is true in some sense for doctors. If somebody is experiencing pain, maybe you treat the pain symptom or maybe you treat the underlying cause. You know, if somebody has a heart attack, you can give them some aspirin, or maybe you perform heart surgery on them to fix the heart attack condition. So you wouldn't say you did the heart surgery for pain. You would say you did it for the underlying problem. So with the antibiotics here, they weren't really pain medication. They were infection-treating medication.
Oh, I agree, Your Honor. Dr. Kim testified that they're useful to cover the soft tissue infections. And I would also, in terms of with your theory, I'd point the court to the Second Circuit's decision in Cole, which is there the person was denied their prescription eyeglasses, so they had double vision depth perceptions problem, and the guy was running into things. And the court said these might not inevitably entail pain, but they meet the test of suffering that Estelle is reached at. So I believe your theory, I believe the evidence and the theory is well supported by the case law. So I don't believe this court needs to look back to its prior decision here. And I also note that Gill did testify that he only felt better after taking the antibiotic. And under the Cooper case and Walker versus Benjamin, a court can credit that testimony, and that's enough to survive summary judgment. So I really don't think that there's anything on with the Penaflor claim. The district court admitted that he had the antibiotic in his hand, that it was reasonable to infer that he had it in his hand, he didn't turn it over for no reason. The only basis that was resolved was injury, and I think there's more than ample evidence in the record about injury here.
I was a little troubled by your theory that it's possible to have an Eighth Amendment violation even if a doctor meets the standard of care. I recognize you're arguing that maybe there's disputed facts on that, but it seems to me there's both an objective and a subjective component to an Eighth Amendment claim, and I don't know how you'd meet the objective part if, in fact, the doctor met the standard of care.
Well, the objective part says, does he have a serious medical need? And so everybody knows, it's undisputed Gill had a serious medical need because he just finished a second rectal prolapse surgery. So the objective component is met, and that's where the standard of care, where it usually comes into play in these cases, is in a pure recklessness case. And what happens is there's no evidence of a warning. There's no evidence of malice. So the court has the bad outcome in front of it, and it has to say, is this outcome so bad that it wouldn't have occurred if the doctor didn't know about it and disregard it? But that's not the situation here. He was expressly warned of it. That shows that he knew about it, as well as the fact that the malice gives the reason why he disregarded it. So I think you can establish the subjective element, and this is what I think the Ledford case in the circuit's getting at, in which Ledford holds you don't need to present evidence of the standard of care to find a violation of the Eighth Amendment.
So you think standard of care in the other cases is really just circumstantial evidence of the deliberate indifference, the subjective part.
Correct.
And if you have direct evidence, so your argument would be if you have direct evidence of animus or malice, then you don't have to care about it.
Yes, that's my position, Your Honor. And I believe it's amply supported by the Dermer, Ledford, and Hathaway cases, which say you don't need to introduce evidence of the standard of care, or in the Dermer case even finds that there could be a violation if the standard of care was followed, if the conduct was for a non-medical reason, if that was why the doctor did what he did. Mm-hmm. And so that's only the claim against Reed. And so that, I think, covers the two Eighth Amendment claims. So we have Penaflor That was based on injury. There is easily evidence of injury here. This court found it before. I pointed to the evidence in the brief. There's his own testimony as well as the testimony of the doctors, which we think, if it's read in the light favorable to him, supports the existence of injury. For Reed, we believe, A, that you can establish evidence of a violation because of the evidence of animus, but also we believe that Kim's testimony could be used to find that there was a violation of the standard of care. So even if this court isn't comfortable with going with that theory, it can still find that there was evidence of a violation here.
That, now, when we evaluate these non-physician personnel, whether it's Penaflor or whether it's the assistant Kedro, is that his name, are they lay people or are they somewhere in between medical professionals and lay people?
I believe the court with, well, Penaflor and Kedro are physician's assistants.
Right.
And I do not know the exact, I believe they've been subject to medical malpractice claims, but they also, like nurses, are also subject to general duties under cases like Brunelli, which is the Eighth Amendment, the Wisconsin claim, which says that prison employees have a duty to provide medical assistance to their people in their confines. And there it holds that a delay could be actionable even without expert testimony.
Mm-hmm.
And so
just wondering whether you hold physician's assistants to any higher standard of care than you would, say, a guard or just a person who's walking down the hall.
I do not know the answer
educator.
To that.
Yeah, okay.
So, but turning to those claims, I think something that I just want to point out here, there's a few errors in the district court's rulings and evaluations of the Federal Tort Claims Act claims, but one of the main ones is just that there's not just medical malpractice claims here. When we're looking at the things against the guards, we're looking at the behavior, these are general negligence claims in which you look at the Brunelli case, you look at the Kujawski case, these are involving delays. They're involving delays in get treatment. These aren't the sorts of issues that are so complex that you need medical personnel on. There are some, like the claim against Reed, the changing the prescription, that's very complex, and that you need to win on that one, we need expert testimony. But for the rest of these, the inability to get care, the inability to see anybody, to go through all these months in serious pain with his rectum popping out, those aren't things that need expert testimony, as those two cases demonstrate.
Characterize those as negligence claims. Aren't they more intentional torts?
There's a possibility. This is why we brought the claims, the Eighth Amendment claims. I guess what we would say is the intentional torts. The only individuals who we think there's evidence of malice in the record here would be Penaflor, Reed, and Kedro. Kedro's is based on his comment that he was dismissive and curt, so I wouldn't say that's really firm. That might be evidence of rushed behavior.
Is Kedro the one who gave him back exercises for the infection?
Yeah, Kedro saw him on March 20th, and this was the Friday before the weekend.
And already the surgical incision spot is irritated. He points, don't the notes show that there's some mass there? There's something odd there, I thought.
Well, the evidence is that Gil had a noticeable bulge, and he pointed to it and said that he's in pain. The notes do not bear that out, though. The notes say that it was a surgical scar, soft, non-tender.
But we have Gil's testimony that it was bulging.
Correct. And here, so Kedro...
And Kedro gave him back exercises.
Yeah, he's a go on your way. And then an officer called, like Gil talked to an officer, who another actor who had a duty, and he said, I can't do anything about Kedro. So he had to sit in his cell for the weekend, as the evidence says, in a fever, chills, and serious pain. And then on Monday, voila, it had grown to the size of a golf ball. And he needed to have 4 lancing and draining sessions following that point, and he needed the antibiotic, which is the segue into Penaflor's behavior.
Well, and it wasn't just an abscess. The notes from March 23rd show that it was... infection / cellulitis / abscess formation. You don't fix cellulitis with lancing.
Correct, Your Honor. And that Dr. Harms testified, if you look at his testimony, he says, I prescribe antibiotics when there's a significant pattern of cellulitis.
Right. So that's in the record.
Correct.
Yeah.
And so the first error is that there's a lot here that you don't need expert testimony, so even though I think we have it on a lot. But the second is the evidentiary law that applies. This court said previously that we're in federal court. It's the federal rules of evidence that apply. It pointed to the Euland case, and where this court said in the federal rules of evidence, in the federal court, federal rules of evidence apply exclusively. And this court applied state law because it found that the court didn't have an express direction to apply it. Is where I think when you actually look at the claims, I don't think you actually need to reach the issue because Gill is sufficient evidence under both. But I think it's clear, A, that the federal standard should apply, and B, also that it's more lenient. So I don't think you can rule against him without finding that it's met. And the reason why I would say that is simply because, as this court described the federal evidentiary standard, it says you don't need expert testimony when the symptoms are not beyond a plaintiff's grasp. And so that's one situation. And another, if you actually look at page 360 of the Ledford decision, it says it distinguishes treatment decisions from delays in examination. So Ledford at 360 says you don't need federal expert testimony for a delay. So there's a lot of cases where the court went through and it looked at these claims and it dismissed the delay claims without expert testimony. And even there, you actually have Dr. Kim's testimony saying, and so what he said was that you have a 5-month, he was saying sooner is better than later to get the surgery if the rectum is popping out, if you have painful things like that. And that's what was happening to Gill. It took him 11 months from when Dr. Heiss recommended that he see a colorectal specialist that he actually was able to get the surgery. 6 months to see the colorectal specialist, and then 5 more months to get the surgery. And I even know, in these things, the district court didn't construe the evidence in the light favorable to Gill. It did it against him, and it even made a few errors. And one of those involves that claim to see a colorectal specialist. The district court thought that Gill wanted to see a second colorectal specialist. He just wanted to see a first. And what happened was, you had the same surgeon. He was able to see the first surgeon who performed the failed surgery.
That's McDonald, who's the general surgeon, right?
Yes. Yeah. And he recommended the same procedure through the abdomen, which posed the risk of nerve damage and impotence. And Gill wanted to see a specialist instead because he was told that there were alternative procedures by Dr. Heiss. And when he saw the specialist recommended that they can proceed anally, which didn't pose those risks. So the government tried to use it against him, like the fact that it was his delay, but I believe there's ample reason to find that it can be attributed to the government. I can go into those claims, but otherwise I'll just reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Levin. We'll hear now from Mr. O'Connor.
Morning, Your Honor. Stephen O'Connor. We believe the district court properly granted summary judgment the second time, based on the expanded record in this case that was developed after reversal the first time we were here. That expanded record includes pretty definitive statements by Dr. Harms, who is the chief of surgery at the University of Wisconsin Hospital, specializing in colorectal surgery, and the defendant or the plaintiff's own expert, Dr. Kim, who does the same thing.
But I don't see how Dr. Kim, just to start with him, can erase what he did historically at the time, including the prescriptions he made, the statements he made about constipating effects of Tylenol 3 versus the Vicodin or other things, his reaction when his advice was not followed. He certainly can say more if he wants to. It reminds me very much of when there's a deposition taken and then somebody files an affidavit and tries to contradict what was said in the deposition. This court holds consistently in that situation that you can't create genuine issues of fact by doing that. I would say it the same way. You can't really erase them. If the facts are there, now you're just a witness who's changing his story, and you can put him on the stand and see which story the trier of fact believes.
Well, the difference is, Your Honor, that Dr. Kim didn't have a story to start with.
Well, yes, he did. He had actions, and actions reveal a lot about what a doctor thinks. You can infer if a doctor prescribes something that that's what the doctor thinks needs to be done. The doctor doesn't have to write after every prescription, and this is what I think needs to happen.
Well, I think that when Dr. Kim prescribed the post the prolapse surgery, the mucosal prolapse, and I'd like to correct counsel, there was not a failed surgery by Dr. McDonald. It was a 19-centimeter resection that was done. It was considerably different than the minor surgery, basically minor surgery, that was done by Dr. Kim a couple of years later. When Dr. Kim wrote his post-surgical prescription, he merely said, this is what we need to do, that this is my recommendation.
We've seen that record, and we've looked at that record in our earlier case, and he was very annoyed when Dr. Reed did not follow his instructions, and he said, you know, do it this time, when he rewrote the same instructions. That's circumstantial evidence from which one can infer what Dr. Kim wanted to happen after that second surgery. Now, years later, in the middle of litigation, Dr. Kim is saying something else, but I don't see how Dr. Kim can take a big eraser and remove from the record the earlier evidence of his professional opinion.
Well, even if you remove from the record his opinion at all.
We don't have to remove anything from the record. It seems to me we have everything now is in the record. We have the evidence of his earlier opinion contemporaneous with the operation, and now we have this deposition. But I'm just saying the deposition can't have the effect of making this a record in which his earlier instructions never existed. They're evidence, and one has to deal with them.
If we're talking about the Eighth Amendment claim against Dr. Reed, then I would point the court to the language in the Snipes case, which says whether and how to mitigate pain is the doctor's decision without judicial interference.
No, but there was a question, though, as there are all sorts of things about whether this non-specialist doctor, Dr. Reed, who was angry, we have evidence in the record, at Gill, because Gill had sued Dr. Reed, was deliberately countermanding the instructions of the specialist because he didn't want to do Gill any favors. That would violate the Eighth Amendment.
Your Honor, I don't think that there is evidence in the record before this court that there's any animus by Dr. Reed. Yes, there was a previous case by this man against Dr. Reed.
And yes, Gill has testified that Dr. Reed said some very snippy things to him.
Well, does snippy make animus when you're trying to decide whether to treat post-rectal surgery
pain? If you remove somebody's laxatives and give them the constipating painkiller?
Well, Dr. Reed had to make a choice on whether to give him an appropriate pain medication or not. He could have given him Motrin, as this court thought could be done 10 days after the surgery.
And maybe even if he had given him Motrin, maybe Gill would have been better off with a less effective painkiller that at least didn't cause impaction for 9 days.
Well, I would point out to the court that the cause of the constipation was not the lack of laxatives. As Dr. Kim said in his deposition, the constipation is caused first by the anesthetic medication that's given to him by a general anesthetic during his surgery.
I understand. Second, you can pick it apart, but the fact is, and your facts are a little off, I think, on when Gill was starting to complain about this. They let him go 9 days before he has an enema. And yes, there are a lot of things, but if there's predictably going to be constipation, you don't take people off laxatives and give them something that will exacerbate the constipation.
Well, that's contrary to what Dr. Harm says. Dr. Harm says he doesn't do that in exactly the same situation. So it's not a matter of taking them off.
Why isn't that at least just a genuine issue fact? Dr. Kim said twice he doesn't prefer to use Tylenol 3 because it constipates.
And Tylenol 3 there is nothing in the record that says it's more constipating or less constipating.
Dr. Kim's testimony says he thinks Tylenol 3 is more constipating.
Dr. Kim said that he had anecdotal evidence, that it's anecdotal history that it's more constipating.
And
he
so
said
that's
it's a
evidence.
Choice Dr. of his position.
Dr. Kim, the professional in this area, thinks it's more constipating. Why are we to say he's wrong about that?
Well, for the reason that I just pointed out in Snipes.
He says he initially prescribed Vicodin because, as he stated in his deposition, quote, it's been known, or at least from my experience, so this is not just him reporting something, that the Tylenol number 3 tend to give more constipations than Vicodin, and it's one of the reasons I don't use Tylenol number 3.
So, and also in that same deposition, Your Honor, he says that it's a physician's choice as to one or the other, and different patients react differently.
Yes, but that's the thing that contradicts what he was doing earlier. That's my problem with your use of the deposition only, as though if we didn't have the earlier evidence of his actions, if he was just a testifying expert and that's all he ever said, that would be one thing. That's not our case.
Well, I understand that your point with respect to Dr. Kim changing his mind, but we also have Dr. Harms, a disinterested third party, saying that, number one, he doesn't use Metamucil and milk of magnesia post-surgery in a routine. He says that Tylenol 3 and Vicodin are interchangeable and have the same risks and the same effects. He also said, Dr. Kim and Dr. Reed, Dr. Harms, both say that they would not prescribe Motrin post-surgery because it is not adequate to the task immediately post-surgery.
But see, whatever Dr. Harms says, if we have evidence in the record on the other side, you can't possibly be arguing at summary judgment. We should, as an appellate court or even the district court on summary judgment, should decide who to believe, Dr. Harms or Dr. Kim's earlier. So even if we take Dr. Harms as an unequivocal supporter of the government, which I'm not sure he is, by the way, there are other things he says that are much more cautiously phrased. But even if he were, I don't see how we could choose between the two stories at summary judgment.
Well, can we move on to Mr. Penaflor?
That would be fine.
With regard to Mr. Penaflor, the district court found, in accordance with this court's previously ruling, that there was an intent to withhold this medication and perhaps even a violation of the standard of care. But there was no harm. And regardless of what counsel believes, I don't think there's anything in the record that supports the fact that there was any harm caused by the failure to deliver that cephalexin on the evening of the 23rd the morning of the 24th.
I have to tell you, my problem with that is an ex post perspective. It looks at what finally happened and looks back and says, oh, he didn't die because he didn't get the antibiotic when he needed to. But the records show that he had cellulitis. Dr. Harms says you need an antibiotic for cellulitis. Cellulitis, readily available information would tell you, left untreated can turn into a life-threatening condition. Now, Gil was lucky. It didn't in his case. It just turned into a ping-pong ball-sized thing. But how you can say there's no harm to leave an infection untreated just because the person didn't die from it seems to me an extreme statement.
With all due respect, Your Honor, I think you're expanding the evidence. The evidence was that this man on the 20th had a soft, non-tender incisional wound that was a week and a half old.
And he reports it's a galloping infection, actually, is what happens, because everything was fine for a while. He reports that there's a bulge. Nobody looks at it very carefully. They give him back exercises. And then, a few days later, it's already expanded into this ping-pong ball-sized thing. If he had gone without antibiotics much longer, we might not have him with us anymore.
Your Honor, the difference is that the inference that there was something drastically or emergency nature wrong on the 20th is simply not supported by any evidence. What we have is a man who had a surgery in early May of 1998, or March of 1998. On the 23rd, he goes to his guard and says, "I want to go see a doctor." And he said, "We don't have emergency 24-hour service. Go see him in the morning." The next morning, he goes in and says, "I've got back pains." He didn't say he's got a pain in his. He has surgical pain. He says, "I've got back pains," and he's had them for 2 days.
But they knew he had just had surgery. Patients report. Look, if somebody came to you and said, "I'm experiencing pain in my arm," you might think that person was having a heart attack, not because you think the heart is located in the arm, but because many of us are trained to understand that pain, people can perceive pain. Surely if somebody's post-surgical, you would look, among other things, at the surgical incision site and see if there's anything to be concerned about.
And that's exactly what the physician's assistant, Kedro, did. He looked at the surgical site and said it's non-tender, soft, non-tender, on the evening of the 20th. 2 days later, or 3 days later, he goes in, and now it's expanded to something that physician's assistant Olay and Dr. Aslam decided needed to be drained and treated, and it was. Contrary, again, to counsel's statements, it wasn't drained and treated four different times. It was drained and treated once, and then it was dressed after that. There was no more draining going on.
Well, because he was also getting the antibiotics for the cellulitis.
And as Dr. Harm said, regardless of what this patient says about what made him feel better, it wasn't the cephalexin.
He doesn't know that. I mean, if it's cellulitis, antibiotics do make you feel better, even though they're not pain medication. Right? I mean, if you had an ear infection.
No, I don't believe they do. I think Dr. Kim, Dr. Harms, Dr. Reed all say that the cephalexin has no effect on pain.
Of course it's not. It's not a pain medication. Penicillin is not a pain medication.
Yes.
But do you feel better after you've had penicillin?
You may, if the infection goes away.
If it cures the infection, sure, you feel better.
But the curing in this case is doing the lancing and the draining of the virulent pus. It is not whether or not you put in a oral antibiotic to treat something later on down the line.
I think this record is not clear about that. I think Gill's testimony, you're thinking that we should place zero weight on Gill's testimony. I'm not sure that that's correct.
Well, I think that there's a difference between inferences, legitimate logical inferences, and speculation about what to the person who's just coming into this. It's a horrible sounding set of facts. It wasn't as horrible as it sounds, and although it can be made to sound horrible, what these doctors and these physicians' assistants were doing were treating their patient to the best of their ability at the time they treated him. Dr. Reed, when Gil came back from Oshkosh and that surgery, gave him the best medicine he could give him at the time. Yes, there was a small difference between giving him the Metamucil, the milk of magnesia, and the cephalexin. Or not the cephalexin, the Vicodin. The Vicodin and the Tylenol 3 are essentially identical. One uses codeine, one uses oxycodone. As to the Metamucil and the milk of magnesia, he said, I don't want to give it to you, for his stated reason was dehydration. 2 days later, 3 days later, when he came back again and said, I'm still not having a bowel movement, he changed his mind. It wasn't like he was treating him with animus. He made a medical decision when the man came back the first time. He said, I'm not going to do that. And it's also in the record from Gill's own statement that he was self-treating with Metamucil at the time. And both, I think it's P.A. Steiner in one of the medical records and Dr. Harms say perhaps that's exacerbating the problem because he's self-medicating. We don't know how much he's taking. So, to lay all of this horrible result on these guys because they make a decision, I'm going to treat this man's pain when he comes back from surgery with the available narcotic medicine that I can give him rather than an analgesic like Motrin in a 400 milligram dosage, just seems to me to be taking the medical profession to the courtroom, and that's not right, I don't think. And I think that Judge Crabb was entirely correct to say that there was no harm caused by the lack of cephalexin for that short period of time, and there was no harm caused by, there's no animus in Dr. Reed in doing what he had to do.
I don't know what made Judge Crabb an expert about that. I mean, I can even think anecdotally of things in the newspaper about people who get galloping infections and they die from it. That's what happens with toxic shock syndrome. It's what happened to Jim Henson. It's what happened. I mean, fortunately, it doesn't usually happen, but one doesn't know beforehand.
Well, I again, Your Honor, with all due respect, the characterization as a galloping infection, I think, is a little overstated.
Well, you don't know how fast it's going to progress, and when a when a specialist has said, I want you to have this medication, they even spend some time deciding whether they want him to have the cephalexin, because some people who are allergic to penicillin, like Gil, according to this record, also have a bad reaction to cephalexin, and they decided for whatever reason that that it was worth the risk for him. So they gave some thought to this prescription, and then when Penaflor just decides not to give it to him, as we have to assume on the basis of this record, I don't see how we can assume no harm, unless we can say, well, a year later he's fine, no harm, no foul.
Those are two different questions. Whether or not he can decide on his own to do it or not, or whether there is harm. The harm in this case has to result after the decision not to do that.
Right, and so there are 12 hours that this infection is progressing at some state, at some pace, that he's not getting it treated. Don't you think that's harm?
No, I don't think that's the case. The fact is that the infection was healing for those 12 hours because of the lancing and the draining and the dressing of the wound.
He didn't get the wound lanced the night that he didn't get the medication.
He did that morning, Your Honor.
The next morning.
No, he got the medication the next morning. The decision.
So there are 12 hours where he doesn't have the medication. He went on the evening line to pick up the medication.
Correct.
He doesn't get the medication, and he doesn't get it lanced right then.
That morning.
So you think 12 hours of untreated infection is fine?
Your Honor, I think you've got the timeline wrong. The wound was the abscess was lanced on the morning of the 23rd. The morning of the 23rd. At noon on the 23rd, Dr. Aslam said, go ahead and give him the cephalexin. At 8:30 at night on the 23rd, Penaflor supposedly withheld the cephalexin.
Right. Okay.
The
okay.
next morning. So during that 12-hour period, it was being treated the way Dr. Harm says this is the way you treat an abscess.
Well, except it's not the way that the prescribing physician wanted it treated, because there was cellulitis involved. And Dr. Harm said in his expert testimony, if there's cellulitis, you need an antibiotic.
Dr. Kim was not the... was not the treating physician at the time. The treating physician was Dr. Aslam and PLA.
Right, and so all I'm saying is the evidence in this record suggests if there's cellulitis involved, you need an antibiotic, or at least there's a dispute, since your expert, Dr. Harm, says you do need an antibiotic if there's cellulitis. I think, if I'm not mistaken. But anyway, you're right about the timeline. I'm sorry about that.
I don't have any other comments unless you have questions, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. O'Connor. Mr. Levin has 3 minutes.
Okay, well, I only have a few mostly record-based points here. The first is that on the morning of the 20th, Gail did, and if you could, this is at SA 110, he did tell the officer that he was experiencing pain around the area of a surgical incision. So that's his declaration that he's testified that. The second involves the amount of lancing and draining sessions. It's Gil's perspective. Gil, it's in the record, which the other side, in fact, said was undisputed, that there was 4 lancing and draining sessions, that on the 24th, the 25th, and 26th, his abscess was further lanced and drained. That's at docket 83 at 7 and 10. It should be the paragraphs 25 and 37, where they said it was undisputed that he had further lancing and draining. So this wasn't, at least as of the record, it's their position there was only one in follow-up, but it's a disputed issue material fact. The third, they claim that Reed changed his prescription, and so that Gil got everything on the 6th. That's wrong. Reed only gave the milk of magnesia at that time. He did not give the Metamucil. The self-medicating that was purportedly going on was with the milk of magnesia only. Gil did not get the Metamucil until later when Kim rewrote the prescription. The fourth regards the state of the record on Motrin. And I do believe there's evidence in the record to show that Motrin was a viable substitute. First, and this is on SA 126 at 127, Dr. Aslam twice switched Tylenol 3 to Motrin. This was, and he specifically told Gil to avoid Tylenol 3 because of constipation. That's on May 10th and May 12th. And the second, this is at SA 453, and this is, I'm going to quote Dr. Kim here. If the pain is manageable with Motrin and they're having constipations, then I guess Motrin is better than continuing with the narcotics or pain medication that has a constipating side effect. So I believe that evidence suffices to create a genuine issue material fact on whether Motrin is a viable substitute. The last point, or Second, the Snipes case, which they referenced, that involved someone who had a toenail removed without an anesthetic. They found there was no serious medical need in that case, so the case is easily distinguishable for, and there also wasn't a specialist in that case. And finally, a lot of what's going on here is they disagree with what's happening and why. Yet, as this court said in Sarsha, intent on issues of intent and motivation, that's for the jury. All that they're doing here are things for the jury to resolve. This is a case where the patient required multiple surgeries and he had serious pain, and it should be the jury should be able to see if he should be able to recover. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Levin. Mr. Levin, you served by appointment of the court. You have the deep thanks of the court for your fine efforts on behalf of your client. Indeed, we thank your law firm for having taken on this difficult task. Indeed, our thanks to both counsel in the case, and the case will be taken under advisement.